But I don't. I really don't have any regrets. I really don't. I've lived exactly how I've wanted to. I've tried my hardest every single time. I didn't win the matches that maybe I should have always won. But I really gave it my all. So that for me is enough.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm James.
This is episode 212. It's been an episode that's been in the making for some time. One that specifically deals with the domestic violence allegations made against Alexander Zverev that men's tennis is currently grappling with or failing to grapple with at the moment.
Yeah, it's been a minute since we've done a tennis episode. And this is, you know, an episode about the things that are floating around just outside of the game itself. Just a warning to listeners, we are going to be including discussions of intimate partner violence and suicide. So if that is something you're sensitive to, please use your discretion.
Where does this story begin?
Roughly 2 weeks ago, Alexander Zverev's ex-girlfriend, Brenda Patea, announced her pregnancy on Instagram, saying that she is pregnant with Sasha's child. She's about, at that point, about 20 weeks along, and that she intended to raise the baby by herself.
That very same day, Alexander's previous ex-girlfriend came forward with allegations that Zverev was physically abusive toward her in their relationship.
Right. So on that day, Olya Sharapova, the previous ex-girlfriend of Alex Zverev, said that a partner had abused her in the past, and she kind of alluded strongly that it was Zverev, and shortly after she confirmed.
Based on the timeline of some of the things that she said, it was deduced, although she didn't state it explicitly then, it was deduced that it was Zverev that she was talking about. Shortly thereafter, she confirmed that it was Alexander Zverev that she was talking about.
Right. Shortly after that news came out, Sharapova agreed to sit down with Ben Rothenberg for a piece in Racquet magazine detailing a little bit more of what she said about her relationship with Zverev.
There are three main tour stops where all of these events are alleged to have taken place, starting with the US Open. Initially, Sharapova describes a physical altercation with Zverev, one part of it where he allegedly put a pillow on her face and sat on it. She manages to escape the room, gets to the hotel lobby. He comes looking after her. She's outside trying to escape the situation barefoot. This is where she's able to show some receipts from that night with WhatsApp messages with her friends telling her to come get her. Pictures of her luggage and her belongings thrown outside of the hotel room in the hallway. She purports that Zverev threw her stuff out,
but kept her passport. John Wertheim on No Challenges Remaining podcast confirmed that it was the actual carpet from the U.S. Open Players Hotel, because he would know. The friend who picked her up in New York and drove her to New Jersey was her close friend Vasyl Surduk, and she gets to the house. Vasyl's stepmom is there, who goes by Mrs. V in the Racquet piece, and both of these people immediately don't believe her story. Vasyl was quoted in the piece saying, "I always trust the guy first, because I'm a guy, even though I've known Olga for so long." So these two have been friends for many years, are very close, and he immediately believed Sasha's story over her, without even hearing Sasha's first. Mrs. V, because of Sasha's status, and because of his charm, decided that Olya was probably overreacting, and invited Sasha to her home that day.
Even though she said that she did not want to see him, she surprises her with Zverev, her alleged abuser, showing up at the place where she's fled for safety. Mm-hmm.
Sasha comes, they talk, they're essentially coaxed back together. Olya consents to going back to the city with him. She goes with him to Laver Cup. There's another explosive altercation, she alleges, that gets physical, and she's so distraught that she attempts to harm herself by consuming a lot of insulin and locks herself in the bathroom. It's hard to imagine the kind of isolation one would feel in this situation, where your close friends don't believe your stories, You're with one of the most popular tennis players in the world. You don't have your family beside you. And this man allegedly has made you feel so small and so worthless.
And the same reason why you're supposed to stay with him even though you are being abused, because he's this young, popular guy with all this potential, is the same reason why you then don't feel able to speak up. Because people are then gonna come at you and accuse you of being a gold digger.
Right. During this incident at Laver Cup, Ben Rothenberg reports that event official actually intervened after Sasha went and got somebody and coaxed her out of the bathroom. So there's an official out there who will not comment because he or she has been asked, because this is a matter of confidentiality.
I'm going to assume that this is an ATP official, because at that time in 2019, the Laver Cup had become an ATP event. The first year it was held, it wasn't. Remember? At that time now, in 2019, it was an ATP event. And from my understanding and observations of being on site and seeing the way players are handled by the ATP, there are very few movements that players make without an ATP official knowing where they are, especially on site. The fact that one of those officials was called to the hotel, you cannot convince me that somebody on some level did not know that something was amiss in this situation from the tour standpoint.
Because that official doesn't just go back to his hotel and not tell anyone that something just happened. You know, the story is a difficult read, as I'm sure you've heard, or if you've read it, you know. She details several incidents of emotional and physical violence that we won't get into much further. At the end of the piece, it's alluded to that there was kind of an escape that was engineered by Olya and Mrs. V in China. And that's where she and Sasha's relationship ended.
And just yesterday, the tennis Twitter sleuths found pictures of Olya in Beijing the day before Alexander showed up with scratches on his neck. They had pictures of him seen the day prior with nothing on his neck, and the very next day with very distinct scratch marks on his neck. And Olya was not seen in Beijing at that tournament from that point on. Right. So there is anecdotal, to an extent, but also pictorial evidence of what possibly happened that day. Which is to say, there's a lot of evidence here. One of the great difficulties with, at least in court, proving domestic violence charges is a lack of evidence. Not because these incidents didn't happen, but because it becomes a matter of he said, she said. And we saw at the start of this whole thing that defenders of Zverev went that route, unsurprisingly. But what we've seen since then is a lot of evidence, more so than one would expect.
And Wertheim pointed out on NCR that none of this necessarily constitutes proof, right? But there is a case being built. We have things, as you said, the photo with the scratch marks on Alexander's neck. Olya offered a very detailed account of what had happened through that relationship that has been corroborated by several different people. She has WhatsApp screenshots. She has photos of herself with bruises on her face and arms. None of these are outright a smoking gun, but it's building a case.
Right, but it's also not just a he said, she said. It's exactly a he said and Olya and Mrs. V and Vassell say.
And it's
at a very minimum. That's before even expanding it if this were to actually go to court. Sharapova says that she's not planning to press charges. She doesn't want to press charges. She just wants her story to be told and to help people who have been in similar situations. But if this were to go to a trial per se, you could foresee that there's even more evidence that could be brought forth.
I mean, we keep saying allegedly because journalists, bloggers, everybody kind of needs to cover their ass in this situation. On that note, I want to talk a little about why do we quote-unquote believe women? You know, you hear that mantra a lot. We believe survivors, we believe women. Is it a wholesale belief whenever an accusation is made, or is there some sort of critical reasoning going on? And I think we always try to err on the side of believing survivors when they come forward for several reasons. But in this case, Olya has provided corroboration. She's provided a first-person account and also photos and WhatsApp stories. And of course, a cynic could say, well, that's easy to make up. But I don't understand what would be the benefit when she's not suing in a civil court. She's not pressing criminal charges. The allegations of being a gold digger simply don't hold water. Where is her book deal? Like, what is she trying to achieve here if she's lying?
She's not asking anybody for money.
Right. And so why do we believe survivors? Firstly, the rate of false reporting, while difficult to quantify, is rare. There have been several published scientific studies trying to get at how frequently are there false reports of domestic violence or abuse. And it's placed between anywhere from 2 to 10%. A little more than half, 55% of domestic violence incidents are reported to police. And so we know that many, many incidents go unreported.
And this is according to the U.S. Department of Justice.
Right. The incidents that go unreported are far, far more frequent than false reports. There are significant barriers that discourage people from reporting domestic violence. It could be family reasons, economic reasons. Are you dependent on this person?
Dependent on this person financially, if you are, you know, two regular folks, perhaps a stay-at-home wife and the spouse is out making all the money, right? You literally have no financial means to leave. Mm-hmm. It could be you're on tour with this person. You've given up your job or means of income to be on tour with this person, and you are then financially dependent on them to keep going, right?
Right.
And then when that person allegedly takes your passport as this potential means of showing you just how dependent you are on them, you know, making you feel even more trapped. And then there's also the bit in this case where even if all those things aren't necessarily true, the people that you count on for emotional support, your friends, the people that you escape to, they don't believe you.
This varies culturally by socioeconomic status for some religious reasons, so many different reasons. Many survivors fear for their physical safety in the future if they do report. If they report and your partner finds out, will they hurt you? Will they kill you before it can even go to a trial?
They fear for the public backlash. It's inescapable in this day and age if you're a public figure or you're making allegations against a public figure that you will not get harassed on social media.
Mm-hmm. And further, a lot of survivors are not comfortable interacting with the police in the first place. This could be because of previous poor interactions with the police, expectations that the case won't be handled properly, the expectation that you will be treated in a demeaning way or in an incredulous way. And finally, so many survivors of intimate partner violence still have love for that partner. I find it incredibly difficult emotionally to separate from that person.
All this is to say, when you question whether a woman is telling the truth, you need to consider all the incredible barriers that are put up that they have to overcome to get to a place of telling their story. It's not a decision that's taken lightly,
right,
and is without serious repercussions.
But domestic violence, unfortunately, is extremely common. In that Department of Justice study that you cited, it said 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men have experienced severe intimate partner violence. 1 in 7 women and 1 in 25 men have been injured by an intimate partner. And 76% of domestic violence is committed against women. And so you'll often see domestic violence discussed in an extremely gendered way, because women are most frequently the victims of intimate partner violence. That's not to say that men aren't, but you can see in a case like this, the alleged abuser can exert far more physical strength over his partner.
One of the things that we've seen in response to this case is people saying, let's not rush to judgment. Let's wait and see if it's true.
Like, what are you waiting for?
Are you waiting for Zverev to confess? To say, yes, I did these things? That just doesn't happen.
And the concept of innocent until proven guilty is a legal standard, right? This applies to a court of law, not Twitter, not blogs, not podcasts. Even newspapers can report this stuff as alleged. We don't have to assume someone is innocent until proven guilty because we are not judges. We're not the people who are convicting them. And it's important for us not to libel or slander someone. But at the same time, it's extremely important to take these things seriously.
What is it that we're protecting when we say, let's wait and see? It's really the accused's reputation. And I want to know, why is, in this case, his reputation more important than her trauma?
Right. And so you'll see with some of the media coverage, some of the commentary on TV that we'll talk about later, Zverev is seen as the protagonist of this story. This is a coming-of-age story where he has faced an adversity that he needs to overcome, rather than a story of a young woman accusing her partner of some extremely serious mental and physical abuse.
For Zverev, there was no hiding from these allegations. The Paris Masters were imminent, and so he showed up in Paris, and Tennis TV, ATP Tour, their social media, they were just carrying on as if nothing was amiss, that nothing was going on. Oh, here's Alex. He's practicing. Oh, wonderful. Joy. The Paris Masters are happening, and he's one of our favorites. The tournament starts. He's asked about it in press. He gives blanket denials. He issues a statement on Instagram on October 29th, where he says, "The last days were quite challenging for me. I will be a father at age 23, and I'm very much looking forward to the child. Even though Brenda and I are no longer together, we have a good relationship and I will live up to my responsibility as a father. Together we will take care of the little person that is about to grow, but I don't want to say more in public about this private subject. I am sure that Brenda and I can manage it without the media involved." This statement had two paragraphs. That was the first paragraph, addressing the first big news.
Because remember, these both came out on the same day.
And then the second paragraph begins, "Then, there are the unfounded accusations of my ex-girlfriend Olga Sharipova, which I read in the media today. They make me very sad. We have known each other since we were children and shared many experiences together. I very much regret that she makes such statements, because the accusations are simply not true. We had a relationship, but it ended a long time ago. Why Olga is making these accusations now, I just don't know. I really hope that the two of us will find a way to deal with each other again in a reasonable and respectful way." Frankly, there are a lot of things in this statement alone that just piss you off. The first being contradicting Brenda immediately, the mother of his child, his unborn child, because she said explicitly, "I do not want to have anything to do with Alexander Zverev. I do not want him raising this child, period."
She said they are currently not in contact and she doesn't plan to share custody.
So when he says we have a good relationship, that is, well, questionable.
But that's a private matter, right?
Like, yeah, that actually is a private matter, yeah.
Right. Their pregnancy, whatever, is not really something that I feel the need to comment on. This is what you choose to do in your private life. Where it escalates is where someone is being allegedly abused.
He says of Sharipova, "We had a relationship, but it ended a long time ago, a year ago." I get that maybe when you're 23, a year feels like a long time, but that is not a long time ago. You've had a whole ass girlfriend and had a baby since then.
Or a pregnancy.
In that year, yeah.
The thing that sticks out for me here is that this is a poorly crafted PR message. I want to know who in his management team approved this, if anyone. He doesn't display any sensitivity to victims of domestic violence.
No.
He doesn't, I mean, in his effort to completely reject those claims, he comes off as extremely callous, because one could easily say, "I condemn acts of violence against women, period."
Instead of saying, "Then there are the unfounded accusations, then there are the serious accusations." Letting folks know, letting your fans know, of which you have many, many fans, that you take this seriously. Domestic violence is a serious issue. That was just a start. We then get a series of statements where he is dealing with this in a very glib, cavalier way, almost laughing at the situation.
Yeah, so it does get much worse in Paris. He said to the media, quote, "I know that there's going to be a lot of people that right now are trying to wipe a smile off my face, but under this mask, I'm smiling brightly. I feel incredible on court. Everything is great in my life. The people who are trying can keep trying." Now this statement has gone far past obliviousness into defiance.
What you just read were his statements on court after the final in Paris. He made the final, losing to Daniil Medvedev. He then, in press, followed up by saying, There's always going to be people who are going to try to put you down when you are on top, and it's up to me if I'm going to let that happen. And I feel like I'm doing quite a good job of not letting that happen, and I'm still enjoying myself. Through this, there are a few chuckles. As long as you still have a smile at the end of the day, I think that's the most important in life. This is, quite frankly, if Alexander Zverev is guilty, straight out of the Weinstein playbook, straight out of the playbook of so many men who have perpetrated domestic or sexual violence against women over the years, and they can count on their status and their privilege of being a man and their privilege of being believed by default to prop them up. He's saying essentially, all I have to do is stay on top and I'll be fine because I'm impregnable up here. You can say whatever you want down there, but I am Alexander Zverev. And as long as I am who I am, I will be fine.
Dare I say this is a Trump-like response? It is, I mean, it's damn near sociopathic because it displays absolutely no sensitivity to the issue of domestic violence. It paints him as the main character in his story, as anyone who is making allegations against him are simply haters who are trying to drag him down. These are very serious allegations from someone you were intimate with, whom you were friends with from when you were tweens.
You purported to care a lot about.
And so if these allegations are false, this is not the statement that you give.
No, if I were accused of these things in his position, especially if I were innocent, I'd be making much more sensitive comments. I'd be taking it much more seriously. And also if I were in his position of having throngs of fans around the world, a lot of them young women, I'd be taking great care to let them know that I take this issue very seriously. But this, as it turns out, is all about him.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible level of narcissism.
And these statements are simply brush-offs.
During that tournament, we saw a couple of really atrocious social media postings from tennis outlets.
It put them in a very weird position, because normally there would be a barrage of social media posts for the players who are doing well in the tournament. Sasha made the final in the Paris Masters. You're going to see tons of tweets and Instagram posts about hyping the final. And you saw remarkably fewer. The day of the Masters final, there was very little talk about it on tennis Twitter.
At the start of the tournament, it seemed like those who were in charge of the socials weren't really grasping what was going on. Or not really caring, because right. They were still doing that stuff. But after a couple of days, we saw a lot less.
But they were wilding in those first few days. After Sasha's win over Rafael Nadal in Paris, Tennis Channel tweeted, "How many players can say they've just secured their second straight win over Rafael Nadal? Not many, but Alex Zverev certainly can after today's semifinal." It's like, okay. Have you heard about what's going on here? Do you feel the need to promote this person at this very moment?
After his opening round match against Ketsmanovic in Paris, Tennis.com tweeted, "Amidst domestic abuse allegations and finding out he will be a father very soon, @AlexZverev is remaining calm and composed on the court. The world number 7 needed just 55 minutes to dismiss Ketsmanovic at the Rolex Paris Masters." Now, in that tweet, they're conflating impending fatherhood and being accused of domestic violence as one in the same hardship.
As essentially rites of passage that young men need to go through in order to grow up and be a real boy.
And that is concretized by this little video segment on Prime Video. I believe they cover the ATP Tour in the UK. A little roundtable video thing where Daniela Hantuchová was there, Greg Rozetsky was there. To his credit, he remained silent. Maybe not to his credit, because he could have said something to, like, disrupt the utter garbage that was on display. There was another gentleman there. I'm not familiar with him, but I'll let you know what they said. Hantuchová said, quote, "Given everything that's happened in his personal life, he deserves even more credit to be able to play like this." And then the gentleman, the unidentified gentleman, follows up by saying, "Because perhaps he's being forced to grow up. We often say, out of adversity comes good things."
So let's take that piece by piece. Hantuchová displays just a horrifying level of internalized misogyny here by saying that Sasha, whether guilty or not, deserves a lot of credit for how he's playing in the midst of these allegations. Just terrible. I mean, this is really horrifying stuff. Then the gentleman says he's being forced to grow up. Out of adversity comes good things. Again, young men are allowed to be boys, allegedly beat their partners.
And still overcome it.
Right.
And that's a win
for them. Yeah. That's an achievement to overcome those things. Because this is an individual sport that is built on personalities, Sasha, again, is seen as the main character in the story, that he is the one who will triumph over adversity, with very little thought to how Olya Sharipova will come out after adversity. Because they can't, I mean, certainly they can't admit that they believe the allegations or not. So Olya is sort of this phantom floating on the edges of this story as someone contributing to Sasha's Bildungsroman, his coming of age story.
And in saying these things, they're continuing to build on this false idea, one that Zverev clearly believes, that if he continues to win, he's able to overcome this and put it behind him. Like, would he be more embroiled if he lost these matches? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
By winning, he's making these allegations less credible. Like, I don't understand what the thought process is here.
It's almost like the commentators don't know how to talk about this. They don't want to talk about it, but it's happening. And so they only know how to frame it in terms of winning or losing, playing well on the court. Because, again, for centuries, domestic violence has been seen as a private matter, as something between a husband and a wife. For so many years, through the 20th century, violence between a husband and a wife didn't even have a name. It was considered normal. Communities accepted it because it was a private matter. And so now we're in a world where women are finally coming forward, and some men are coming forward, and saying, I have been abused. This is everybody's business. It's everybody's problem. And the media commentators are simply not prepared.
This is also a player who's shown an incredible lack of judgment this entire year, starting with the pandemic. He played the French Open with a fever. He fled the Adria Tour.
He did all that maskless partying in the south of France and in Monaco that, you know, of course, people posted on Instagram. And the US Open was supposed to be his redemption moment, where his parents had tested positive for COVID. He cried about them on court. It was very touching because it's real. It's human. And then a few weeks later at the French Open, he goes on court with symptoms of COVID. Thank God he did not test positive. But this is extremely reckless behavior. And at the time, fans of Zverev, all they could do on Twitter was cry about the fact that Ben Rothenberg asked him a very mean question about playing. And then argue, well, the question wasn't inappropriate, it's just who asked it. And
now some are saying these allegations are less credible because Ben Rothenberg did this story with Olga Sharipova, which is mind-blasting to me.
Because in order for this to go to print, they probably consulted lawyers. This is on Racquet magazine if these allegations are false, right? They could be held liable for printing libelous statements. And of course, Ben was extremely careful to use allegedly and to not say this is the gospel truth of what happened. This is what Olya is saying has happened. And so I know that we give Ben a little bit of trouble on this podcast, but I think he did a very sensitive and responsible job in covering the story. And when you say, why did Ben have to do it? The answer is, why did Ben contact this person first? There are a lot of reporters out there. Why didn't they cover it?
We'll get to that a little bit later, because there's something I want to add with respect to the ATP's deafening silence on this issue. The pivot that we want to make here is from Zverev to the ATP. We happen to think that Zverev's handling of this situation, his glib, narcissistic propping up of himself as someone triumphing over the haters, is atrocious. That is a fact as far as we're concerned. But then, what is the ATP's responsibility in all of this? What should we expect from them to address this situation? Keep in mind, this is not the first instance of domestic violence allegations made against one of their top 30 players this year. Basilashvili is dealing with an actual court case in Georgia, in his home country, as we speak, and the ATP has been completely mum on the matter the entire time.
He's been playing all through the restart. He's been, I mean, he can barely win a match, but he has been playing, has not been sanctioned, no statements from the ATP at the minimum.
I suppose that makes him more guilty because he's not winning, right? If we follow the logic.
Let's ask Daniela, yeah. But journalists have now started to speak out and say this is actually baffling, that they've never seen something quite like this in sports that they've covered, that the ATP has not said a word, not even a bad statement, no statement at all. One of your top players, your leading youth prospect, someone who you're banking on to take the ATP into the post-Big Three era, has been accused of something very, very serious.
Someone who's been the face of the so-called next gen for years now.
John Wertheim, in his latest column, did the ATP a favor and drafted a statement for them. And he said it should include things like, we condemn domestic violence in the strongest possible terms, and we are launching an independent investigation on the accusations. Simple, right? Any corporate communications person could draft that in 5 minutes.
Instead, they were approached by Ben Rothenberg for the Racket magazine piece, and they referred him to their code of conduct. And in that code of conduct, do you want to get into what they could be hiding behind?
Yeah. If you're interested, you can simply Google ATP player conduct, and you'll find something called The Code. In Article 805A2, you'll see a section called Conduct Contrary to the Integrity of the Game.
This bullshit again. This spirit of the game, conduct of the game, integrity of the game. This ambiguous description.
So when Ben reached out to the ATP for comment, they did respond, but they did not address the allegations per se. They directed him to Zverev's denial and to this section of the ATP Code of Conduct. What they mean by conduct contrary to the integrity of the game is anything that hurts the favorable reputation of the ATP, its tournaments, and players being valuable assets and creating tangible benefits for all ATP members. Accordingly, it is an obligation for ATP players and related persons to refrain from engaging in conduct contrary to the integrity of the game of tennis. And they outline a few different ways that that integrity can be violated. Section B says, a player that has at any time behaved in a manner severely damaging to the reputation of the sport may be deemed by virtue of such behavior to have engaged in conduct contrary to the integrity of the game of tennis. C and D talk about a player convicted of a violation of a civil or criminal law of any jurisdiction, and that person may be deemed, again, to have violated the integrity of the game. The next paragraph has similar language about being convicted of a violation of a civil or criminal law, and it goes further in saying that the ATP executive vice president may provisionally suspend a player from further participation in ATP tournaments pending a final determination of the criminal or civil proceeding. So this implies that that player could be suspended while the criminal proceedings are going on, before that person was found guilty or not guilty.
Section E says, violation of this section shall subject the player to a fine of up to $100,000 and or suspension from play in ATP Tour or ATP Challenger Tour tournaments for a period of up to 3 years. Now, there's a lot of vague language in here. There's a lot of language to hide behind. What are the things that we've seen the ATP Tour take action on in the past? We've seen it on cursing, on smashing rackets, on being disrespectful to umpires, betting.
Yeah, it's most frequently having to do with the actual play of the game. Something that happens on court or directly related to something that happens on court. Like you said, betting. Nick Kyrgios, for example, said earlier this year that the ATP was extremely corrupt, and they didn't punish him under this section, but they did issue a statement very swiftly condemning what he said. It doesn't make them look very good now that they haven't even issued a statement for this. What I suspect, and I can't be sure of, what I suspect is they're leaning on this section C and D, which talks about violations of laws. And so rather than acting now, they're going to wait to see if a criminal or civil matter comes to court. That's what I think. However, the first section gives them very broad leeway to act if someone behaves in a manner that is damaging to the integrity of the sport. And in this case, the allegations would probably fall under that very broad definition.
Mm-hmm. What that tells me then is that they don't take it seriously. It also tells me that they're banking on the fact that tennis is so underreported. It's not like the NFL, where you have a concentrated US-based media that has a news cycle that continually regenerates itself. It's always going. If you get wrapped up in that news cycle, you're not going to leave it. It's something that you have to address. With tennis, you have events being played all over the globe in multiple different countries. You do not have the same set of reporters covering every single tournament. People are like, why aren't more people covering this incident? Why aren't more people covering these allegations? Why is Ben Rothenberg the one who has to do it? I would believe it more if somebody else didn't. Mm-hmm. Well, there is nobody else. Tennis reporters are not making money off of covering tennis. It's why we've seen so many of the familiar names flock to tennis majors, something that sprung up from Patrick Mouratoglou in this COVID era, to write stories because people aren't being paid. You have right. to chase the money where you can get it. And
reporters cannot comment on the story. They need to report. They need to report first. This is what they do. And I understand that social media has sort of blurred the lines between armchair commentator and journalist, but a journalist is not going to tweet or write a story about this without actually doing genuine reporting. And as you said, Ben is the only one so far who has really done that.
And so when the ATP knows that this is not a story that's going to gain traction in big markets, in big newspapers, it's not going to get a segment on ESPN.
Sponsors are not dropping them.
You're not going to turn on SportsCenter and hear Alexander Zverev has been accused of so-and-so. You're going to get a 30-second clip of Zverev beating Nadal to make the Paris finals. That's what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. There's no airspace. There's no written space for this in the sport journalism landscape. So the ATP can hide behind that. We can talk till we're blue in the face on tennis Twitter, which in itself is a subset of Twitter that shows you how niche tennis is.
Right. And a small subset of tennis fans across exactly. the world.
So we are just shouting into a vacuum, whereas this story just does not penetrate anywhere. So who is going to hold the ATP to account? They're banking on the fact that this story will just go away and that they just don't have to deal with it. Mm. That's my take on it.
So far, it's one piece in Racquet Magazine. It's a few pieces written in other languages. It's TV commentary. And it's a dedicated group of essentially trolls on tennis Twitter not letting them forget about this. But
a lot of them being Zverev fans.
Yes, or former Zverev fans. Mm-hmm. To their credit, so many fans of Sasha Zverev, I mean, they flipped immediately. Like, so many fans said immediately, we believe her. This is really disappointing because we like Sasha, we're fans of him, but we believe her. But those people can be so easily brushed aside by the ATP, by the Tennis Channel, because what power do they have? When the numbers start to grow, and when reporters and commentators start to key into what's going on the grassroots level, which is tennis Twitter, attitudes can begin to change.
But you're also able to understand just how difficult it is for women to come forward and speak out, because there are so many levels at which this story can get stifled. Mm-hmm. Zverev's employers, in effect, he's an independent contractor of the ATP, they have taken the stance, as they have with Basilashvili, to just completely ignore it.
Right, they haven't even taken a stance. It's just complete obliviousness.
And this is totally out of step with any serious major sporting organization in the world today. Mm. I think that's important to note. Yeah. Every credible sporting organization has something on the books to deal with this kind of thing and will speak up about it. And if tennis wants to grow and become a bigger sport and to take a bigger piece of the pie, this is part of the process. You have to show that you take yourself seriously. You can't be hiding behind these vague clauses in your code of conduct to try and prop up and protect your players.
Let's talk about the NFL for a moment. As an example of a league that was extremely bad at this for a long time and has completely turned the corner. They established a domestic violence policy in 2014 after completely failing at handling the Ray Rice incident. And this incident, you may remember, was caught on tape.
Was that the incident in the elevator?
It was in an elevator. He hit his fiance or partner so hard that he knocked her unconscious. So there's no denying that this happened because it was on tape. The suspension was small. The criminal proceedings were unsatisfactory. And the NFL got roasted pretty badly for this. So as a result, later that same year, they instituted a broad policy about domestic violence and how they would handle it. They included a broader set of infractions, so including actual or threatened physical violence, assault and battery, stalking, harassment, intimidation, and sexual assault. It set a baseline suspension of 6 games for any infraction, and aggravating circumstances could increase that suspension. What's very interesting here is the policy also sets out new services for survivors of violence. There's league-funded counseling, there's treatment services for families, and establishes a compulsory education program for NFL teams and staff. Reportedly a very powerful session on domestic violence that all NFL teams have to go through. And one of the domestic violence experts that was interviewed at the time said that it's important that this policy is malleable, it's changeable, and that the punishments are not draconian, because very often extremely draconian punishments are damaging to the victims and survivors. It can discourage reporting and it can harm families. So at the minimum, the ATP needs to have a policy and a protocol on how to deal with something like this. It is so basic. And what you could say is exactly what John Wertheim said. We condemn domestic violence. You don't have to say that you
believe he's guilty.
Right. You don't have to condemn the player, but you say we are going to conduct a thorough, independent investigation. And if we find there is some truth to this story, here's what we'll do.
And this is where they are particularly out of step and awful right now. Allegations have been made where a tour official, we think.
Or a Laver Cup
or
official.
Or a Laver Cup official.
Either way, that's an ATP tournament.
Mm-hmm. There is an actionable piece of information where you can investigate. You can speak to that person and go from there. You simply say, this is an ongoing matter. We treat domestic violence seriously. We will conduct the internal investigation. And in this case, there are things you can actually investigate.
Right.
And then you come back and provide your findings. In the meantime, you do not look like a complete farce of an organization. This is an organization that propped up Justin Gimelstob, has propped up Basilashvili, has done nothing on this issue. They have nothing to say about issues of inclusion on the tour. This was the first year that the ATP or ATP subsidiaries in their social media even acknowledged Pride Month.
Mm.
Right? The ATP is so behind on these issues. They just want to ride the coattails of the big three and hope that the next gen transition into similar status.
And the burden of proof in an internal investigation is not as high as a criminal court, right? You don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these things happened. The ATP sanctions players for non-criminal offenses all the time, for cursing on the court, for damaging equipment on the court. Like, there are a lot of conduct and decorum violations that are well within the ATP's purview. This is something that it's extremely serious, but it seems like they view it as a private matter that they don't want to get into. So why is tennis so rinky-dink? Why are they so bush league? Because as you said, these things keep happening and the ATP is left holding the bag. Because there are not policies and practices in place to deal with these issues when they come up.
If I'm a WTA player and there's all this talk much quieter now, but all this talk at the start of quarantine about a merger between the two tours. This is something I'm looking at with side-eyeing looking all over the place, because you have two of the top 30 ATP players being accused of this stuff, and I'm supposed to attach myself to that product?
Right, like, who works in HR in the ATP? Who writes your policies? I mean, you could literally copy policies, cut and paste from the NFL, NBA, MLB. All of the American major sports have protocols that they use now to deal with this because they messed up so badly in the past. So why is tennis repeatedly failing to learn from other leagues' mistakes?
One of the big takeaways in watching this story unfold, even if you believe in Zverev's innocence, but just from the way he's handled it, from the way the tour's handled it, is how easily and constantly believed men are, and how they are propped up at every turn, how they are coddled at every turn. It seems to me that Zverev has been told no very few times in his life.
Mm. When I read his statements, my first thought was, wow, how bad is his management? And then I realized his management is Team 8, the management company co-founded by Roger Federer and Tony Gottsick. Tony Gottsick is his agent. What are they doing? They're asleep at the wheel. And they have an incredible financial incentive to keep this kid on the up and up. They've invested a lot of money. Their business plan is to establish a small group of elite, iconic athletes.
The exact quote is, Team 8's objective is to represent a small set of iconic athletes and to ensure that their career trajectory keeps moving in the right direction. This would run contrary to that.
Right. So they have a very small number of athletes they represent. And it's just baffling to me that they haven't been able to intervene with Sasha and craft better statements and show at least a bit of sensitivity, even if the allegations are false.
You may say, well, I want to hear Roger speak on this publicly. I would love to as well. Failing that, he actually has the inside line to have this dealt with in a public way better through that Team 8 management company. He doesn't have to have his face on it.
Right.
But the management, which is representative of him, could do a better job.
Team 8 could say, you have embarrassed us and you need to fix it. And here's the script. You know, like, this is what agents and PR people do. It's crazy to me. There have been very, very few people from within tennis who have spoken in support of Olya Sharapova. I can think of one.
Daria Gavrilova, from the start, has been saying that I believe Olya. She had all these hashtags with her tweet. And then she went on a podcast called Jules on the Hustle with Julie Elbaba, saying, I love Sasha, and when I saw his statement, I was like, come on, you're better than that. This was after she had said that she felt it was important, given that nobody was standing up for her, to believe the woman, to say publicly that I believe her, because too often nobody stands up for the woman and the men are able to just carry on unchecked.
She did not hesitate. She spoke up very, very early after this happened, and she hasn't really been joined by any of her peers. There are a few players who are on the total opposite side of the spectrum from Gavrilova. Antonia Lautner, the German tennis player, said, I know Alex for a very long time, and he's 100% not an abuser. Belinda Bencic chimed in and said, agree. Now,
how do you know that?
Exactly. I mean, you know, to be fair, we don't know if the allegations are true, but for the many, many, many reasons that we outlined early in the episode, we are inclined to believe them. Bencic is inclined to not believe them, which is her prerogative. But the sort of piling on of Olya Sharapova is really disappointing because she's been subjected to a lot of misogynistic and xenophobic comments saying that, of course, a Russian woman would say this. She's a gold digger. She's lying. She's trying to ruin Alex Zverev. And Zverev has gone through his Instagram and deleted all the negative comments and left the supportive ones. right? Like, these are not the actions of a contrite or innocent person.
Where do we leave this on this episode?
I suppose where we leave it is that we hope the ATP, as the men's tennis organization, understands its responsibility here in creating a policy for domestic violence that allows for an investigation, for possible suspension with pay of the player pending investigation, and at least explains to the world that they take accusations like this very seriously. Mm-hmm. And
to not have one of your star players go out on court, give an interview, and then in press afterward, pretending like this is all a game.
I think it's very important to mention that the lack of a clear policy here is damaging to the accused as well as the accuser. As the accused person, let's say you're innocent. You want to know, what is my league doing for me? Right now, their silence has muddied the waters.
It's time for the ATP to step up and stop being Bush League and stop pretending that tennis does not exist outside of the lines on the actual tennis court. Time and time again, we see the tour fail to address any of these concerns across a broad swath of issues. And it's simply not good enough in 2020. It's not good enough if you want to be taken seriously as a professional sporting organization. And for a new president of the ATP, this is not the shift in tone, the shift in action that we would have hoped to see.
Thanks for listening to this rather serious episode of The Body Serve. We will be back on
very soon,
the probably. Funny stuff soon.
Well, I don't know how funny it'll be, but it'll be more regularly tennis scheduled programming. Mm-hmm. There was other stuff on the agenda having to do with the tour finals and the Paris Masters that we were going to talk about. It was on the agenda, but it didn't feel in step with what we were dealing with on this episode. So we'll let this stand alone and then come back again soon. Ish with other stuff.
If you would like to get in touch with us, we are at thebodyserve@gmail.com. We don't often list our email, but you can feel free to email us. We are on Twitter and Instagram at thebodyserve. I'm James at ElliotJMR on Twitter.
Two L's, two T's. I'm Jonathan at tennis_John.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, all your podcast apps. Leave us a review if you're so inclined. And thanks for listening.
Till next time.